Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. One of the enduring tragedies of the events of the Middle East of the past two decades has been the cascading series of large-scale humanitarian catastrophes that come to our collective attention, then just as quickly fade away. One such event, a genocide, took place in August 2014. It was conducted by ISIS fighters when they attacked a small Iraqi religious minority, the Yazidis, who took refuge on Mount Sinjar, a mountain in northern Iraq, where they had no food or water, little weapons, and used the power of social media to arouse the world's conscience. A young former interpreter for U.S. Special Forces, Shaker Jeffrey, was one of the organizers of the resistance. But that's far from the only remarkable item in his life. Jeffrey was the youngest interpreter and worked with the military for around 4 years in Iraq. During the Yazidi genocide, Jeffrey organized the resistance and helped free 100 women and girls captured by ISIS fighters as slaves. Today, he lives in Germany, still working with underground volunteers to help free more ISIS prisoners who have been smuggled into Turkey, Syria, and elsewhere. And he's a wanted man himself, as he awaits a promised visa to the U.S. for his service in Iraq, a program the Trump administration has virtually ended. My guest today is Catherine Holstein, a writer and human rights advocate who tells Shaker Jeffrey's story in the book Shadow on the Mountain, a Yazidi memoir of terror, resistance, and hope. It's published by DeCapo. Catherine Holstein, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Tell us about how you first met Shaker Jeffrey.
I was living in San Diego all during the Iraq War. I was living in a heavily militarized district, so I was around soldiers all the time. And I met him through his commanding officers, Captain Robert Brownsword and Lieutenant Colonel Jay McGone. And they knew I had wanted to write about the Yazidis, who were slaughtered right after the Iraq War in 2014 in Iraq. I'd read about them and I'd heard about the genocide. And I was also interested in the Iraq War because I was surrounded by it at the time. And they told me, you must meet our combat interpreter, Shaker Jeffrey. He'll blow your mind. And so I said, okay. And they hooked us up. And then the first time I met him was over Skype, and we had a 5-hour phone call. And I didn't really know much about him other than the fact that he was a combat interpreter who had saved women who were taken into slavery, because that's what happened during that genocide. And that's why I was particularly interested in it. And that he was in some sort of trouble. And we spent so many hours on the phone. And after I heard his story, I knew that the world needed to hear the story. He gave a different angle on the war and on the genocide than anybody else. And we became very close after that and started working together.
Now, he was a combat interpreter during the surge in 2007, I believe. Is that right?
7 and 8. It's
right.
Sort of nebulous. He remembers it being between 7 and 8. Yeah.
Right. He was only 17 and sort of almost, I think he got in a little young as a combat interpreter, but he worked for the Americans for a number of years. And the genocide that you spoke about, that happened in 2014 after the drawdown of American troops and when ISIS was growing in influence and in territory in that region. First of all, I think it'd be interesting to tell us a little bit about the Yazidi. The Yazidi are an interesting minority. We know about the Kurds, we know about the Sunni and the Shia. The Yazidi are a minority within sort of the larger Kurdish area.
Yes. So they're in the northern region of Iraq, and they've been particularly vulnerable because they practice one of the few religions in the Middle East that are outside of the Abrahamic faith. They have an oral tradition. They don't have a book, which is known as the Huma, which makes them illegitimate in the eyes of others in the region. They don't have holy texts. So for that reason, they've been historically persecuted, also because their religion practices worship of angels. They have 7 angels, and one of them didn't feel that he should submit to the other angels, and he fell down to earth where his tears quenched the fires of hell, and he went back and is now the Yazidi's main angel who sort of intercedes between God and earth. And for that reason, because there's a fallen angel, especially the extremists who in their own text have a fallen devil, Shaitan, they think that that angel, the peacock angel, the Yazidi peacock angel, also known as Melek Taus or Tuusi Melek, there are different names. They believe he's a devil. They've never really looked into it further, and for that reason, they've decided that the Yazidi should be slaughtered in much the same way that the Nazis viewed the Jewish population. They just don't think that they're legitimate, they're subhuman, and the world would be better off if they weren't there.
We refer to this area of Iraq as the cradle of civilization, but it was also the cradle of religions, and there are a number of religions that were born in this area, the Yazidi being one of them, and they're often lumped with the Kurds, but they have different belief systems, and they've generally been a persecuted minority at times throughout their history on this particular part of the land going back to the 12th century.
Yes, they have. I mean, it's all down to the devil worshiping issue that has never been resolved. And it's surprising even now with all of the ability to research, because ISIS has great capabilities in online and getting information. They just refuse to accept because it's part of their tradition going back, as you said, for centuries to go after the Yazidi. And even the Christians who were persecuted in Mosul, for example, in June of 2014, ISIS took over Mosul, but the Christians were allowed to go or stay and pay tax. They had no violence at that time perpetrated against them. The Yazidis, on the other hand, of course, they were slaughtered. So that's all down to the text, the book, and this has been going on. This is the 73rd genocide. It's still going on. People don't realize that they've gone through. So it's quite a terrible situation, and it's just getting worse all the time.
Now, Shaker Jeffrey is pretty amazing survivor of that genocide, not only that genocide, but of his years as an interpreter. He's fluent in Kurdish, English, Kurmanji, and Arabic. So he's obviously very educated, young man.
Yes, he also speaks German now. He has an ability with language, and many Yazidis actually do. I speak to his cousins who are still in the KRG, and I've spoken to other Yazidis, and it's quite amazing to me their ability with language. They really respect learning, and they're very conscious of education. And one of the only good things that Saddam did provide to everyone was a free education. And so the Yazidis were really able to take advantage of that, at least. And they were, even though they were subjected to propaganda and all kinds of other things, they did get good education for a time. So, and he's also a Shaker, just happens to be very, very curious, very smart, and started speaking English young because when the United States invaded, the American troops were located around his village to protect it. And so he became fluent first in American slang more than anything else. When I first spoke to him, he was speaking slang a lot.
Well, in 2007, funny. He became an interpreter. What persuaded him to work with what other people might have considered as American invaders during the war? What persuaded him that he should work with the United States?
For him, it was a many-faceted decision. First of all, he had no father. His father had died. His family was in serious debt. And the Yazidi are really just a poor farming community. They're pacifists. And not having money was a real problem. They weren't able to eat properly or clothe themselves. And so he ran away to Mosul to earn money to give to his mom. However, probably the most salient reason would be that during the time when the Iraqis and the U.S. were working together during the occupation, Shaker got to know a great number of soldiers, one in particular, Sergeant White, who was stationed outside of Kanasore, which is Shaker's little village. And he would go and sell Coca-Cola to the troops for a little profit. And Sergeant White was the first African-American that Shaker had ever met. And they sort of had a funny meeting where Sergeant White introduced himself as Sergeant White, and Shaker said, "No, you're black," because the English wasn't quite there yet. Right. And that's how they bonded. And that was the beginning of they became best friends. And he was at the base every day outside of Kanasore selling Cokes. And then they started playing football with the whole contingent and the village kids out in the desert. And people would sit around having almost like an American barbecue, watching the troops play with the Yazidi children. So they became braided to village life. And Shaker it filled a hole for Shaker. The abyss that the death of his father left was really filled by Sergeant White. Unfortunately then, though, as the war went sideways, some of the men didn't come back. And it was a devastating blow to him to suddenly realize what war was. And he knew, and his family knew, and every Yazidi knew, that if the Americans did not do well, that they, Yazidi, were going to be slaughtered. Because their hope was that the Americans would bring peace for them and protect them. Because finally, they had somebody from the outside coming in who sort of watched over them. And so he went down to Mosul and decided for all of the troops who were dead and for Sergeant White that he was going to sign up and help them finish the mission.
And for a number of years, in fact, that is what he did. He was working as an interpreter. He was wounded several times and apparently was an important part of the war effort in his part of Iraq and was a great help to the American forces.
Oh, yes, he was. The interpreters are actually essential to the mission. And that's, you know, a quote from David Petraeus, who was who's general and commander of all the coalition forces at the time. They're essential because they're the only bridge between the population and the troops. Because Americans don't speak Arabic, and they don't speak Kurmanji, and they don't speak Kurdish, etc. So when they land in a country and they occupy, you've got to have a bridge between the population and the troops, or you're not going to succeed. So he really provided cultural insights, and he provided the direct interpretations, and he also could give all kinds of geographic information. So they're really, really critical, these interpreters, to the people they work with and to the mission that any brigade team has. So they're lifesavers, really. People don't realize that, but they're, without them, a lot more people would die on the American side.
Of course, as he became more trusted, he went from being a battleground interpreter, but oftentimes he would be involved in interrogations, which really in many ways was detrimental to him after the American drawdown because people would see him and recognize him as an interpreter.
Oh, yes. In fact, even during those interrogations with some of the nefarious terrorists that they captured, and he would be interpreting during the interrogation, they would spot him as a Yazidi. They could tell by the way he spoke. And Yazidis were known to be great English speakers, especially ones from Shaker's village. They had a English teacher named Jassim, who is a Sunni Muslim, and he was an excellent English teacher, and literally hundreds of his students ended up being interpreters. And so he would be recognized and marked. And all of them were marked afterward anyway. ISIS kept very careful records, and the Al-Qaeda did, you know, when they merged together. They kept very careful records of who was a Terp, where they were, and they went after them during the withdrawal or after the withdrawal. They would target them because the Terps would not carry a weapon, which made it very obvious when they were out on patrols who the Terp was. And so they would be a target. Find the guy without a piece, shoot that one. That's the traitor working for the infidels. And so he was routinely shot at just for being a Terp while they were out on mission.
My guest today is Catherine Holstein. She's a writer and human rights advocate. This is her second book titled Shadow on the Mountain, a Yazidi memoir of terror, resistance, and hope, in which she tells the story of Shaker Jeffrey, who was known by Michael as within the American forces as an interpreter. But of course, the book doesn't end with his interpreting work ends. It actually, that's where the book really becomes quite harrowing. Obviously, he's targeted as the American drawdown takes place, but he stays in Iraq at the time. What led to that decision? I guess it was family?
Yes, a lot of people stayed. They didn't believe, first of all, that it was going to get as bad as it was going to get. They didn't believe that because the Americans had just been there, and they left behind a huge arsenal of weapons, especially in Mosul. They left behind MRAPs, and they left behind Humvees, and they left behind all kinds of weapons. And so they figured that that would protect them. They're also constitutionally, under the Constitution of Iraq, Article 114, the Kurdish armies, who are right close to their territory, Peshmerga armies, are supposed to protect them. That is mandated by the Constitution. And Shaker was always citing that Article 114 because they were bound to protect the Yazidi, and they didn't in the end, which is why, one of the reasons why, there was a failure to protect them. And also, they really didn't believe that ISIS was going to cross the Sykes-Picot line and come in and come after them. They thought that they were after the oil. They were after Mosul, which was the, you know, the jewel in the crown of Iraq is Mosul. And they figured they wanted the money, they wanted the oil, and they weren't interested in the empty dirt, as Shaker and his Yazidi brethren call it. They call it empty dirt. They didn't think they wanted it. So they were a bit naive, considering their history. Shaker knew there was a chance that, you know, they were going to get attacked. And he made sure that people got weapons, which were later taken away. And so he really, it just, we can all say that we would leave, but you never really know how you're going to act when it actually happens. And so you think you have more time and you don't also.
So in August of 2014, ISIS is making a move on their territory. The Kurdish protector, the army units that were protecting them withdrew. And basically, ISIS, elements of ISIS came in and began killing.
Yes. Shaker, because he'd been a combat interpreter, he knew all of the commanders in the Iraqi army, and he also knew the commanders in the Peshmerga. And in the run-up to the invasion, which took many months, they didn't, you know, they didn't come right across and just go after the Yazidi. They took enormous amounts of territory in Iraq first. They stampeded through towns, and Iraqis who now had television, they didn't during the invasion, proper television of 2003, but now they had access to their information and they could see that ISIS was going to take Mosul. It was shocking to everyone when Mosul fell because it was so heavily fortified. And so ISIS just came in, took Mosul, and they came up afterward, declared the genocide, but nobody really expected it to happen that fast. It was very, very quick, lightning fast. If you recall, the whole world was shocked to wake up and see that Mosul was taken. And the Yazidis were just as surprised that Mosul was taken. That was the big shocker. And by that time, it's too late to do anything.
Yes. And eventually they did attack the villages where the Yazidi lived. And these Yazidi fled to a mountain, Mount Shingal, which, of course, became the scene of many desperate pictures and pictures that made it out to the West of these Yazidi basically taking refuge on the mountain, on a mountaintop with no water, no food, no shelter, and basically awaiting for the world to do something.
Yes. So the Peshmerga abandoned them on the morning of the invasion before dawn. They abandoned without firing a single shot in defense of the Yazidi, and they took off. I think they had something like 1,000 tanks. They had lots of Peshmerga in the region, and then they suddenly just retreated back to Kurdistan without telling the Yazidis. And so the Yazidis were sitting ducks. ISIS came in and they had to flee. They had nowhere else to go. If you imagine, it's just a big desert and it's hot. And the only refuge that the Yazidi had was Mount Shingal, which is also, you might have heard it called Mount Sinjar, which is the sort of more common name. We use Shingal because it's the one that the Yazidis use. And I wanted to respect that. They fled to the mountain. It's their sacred mountain. They have lots of temples up there. They go there to worship. So everybody knows to go to the mountain. It's been their refuge for generations. So they all fled across the desert, climbed up the mountain with ISIS sort of surrounding that mountain like a lasso and shooting at them, grabbing the girls, grabbing the men, slaughtering the men, taking the girls into slavery. So they were just running for their lives. Some of them had no shoes. They didn't have anything. And when they got up to the top of the mountain, it's in the middle of the summer. It's 110 degrees. There's no shade. There are really very few trees up there. They don't have any food, and there's no water supply. If they go down again, they get shot because ISIS was just waiting, like sharks waiting to come after them. And it was a terrible situation. They were basically just abandoned completely, and the world, that was probably the first time the world ever heard of the Yazidi, was when those first reports came in of these tens of thousands of Yazidis trapped on that mountaintop with nowhere to go and nothing to eat, nothing to drink.
What did Shaker do during that siege, basically?
Well, that was the most amazing part. He showed his resourcefulness. He brought cell phones with extra batteries. Some people had trucks up there so that they could charge batteries. And this genocide was one where technology, probably the first time ever where technology played such a huge role, because he was able to connect with his military brothers back in the United States. They knew what was going on, and he connected with them via cell phone, via Facebook. They got information from him about what was going on, and he was begging them for help. And in the end, what they did was connect him to members in the government. And Shaker, at first, they thought he was a spy. They didn't believe that he was really up there giving them credible information. And he had to prove himself to the American government, by going down the mountain and getting exact locations of ISIS contingents. And it's in the book how he runs around that mountain by himself, largely, and gets the GPS coordinates of all the ISIS contingents that he can find, how many weapons they have, what their activities are. And they tethered him. His cell phone signal was tethered to CENTCOM, so they were getting that information. And once they realized who he was and what he was doing, he started doing more and more of that. And at the same time, he was going down the mountain and saving the girls who'd been taken into slavery. His own girlfriend, who he planned to marry, was taken into slavery. These girls were also calling him on their cell phone and saying, I'm in this warehouse, or I'm trapped in this school. They're going to take me on in a bus to, you know, wherever, to Lafar or to Mosul to sell me. So he was trying to get as many out as he could while also giving information to the United States. And he really coordinated every single day with those Americans, and then also with the press. Then he had CNN calling him, and he had the BBC. And it was an insane situation, all while he has nothing to eat or drink. So it's an amazing, his courage is an amazing story. It's just crazy what he was doing up there. I was, the first time I spoke to him, actually, he started with that, because I think he wanted me to really get it as a writer and as an advocate, what he'd gone through. That's a big part of the climax of the book.
Yeah, eventually supplies were dropped, and eventually an escape route was opened so the Yazidis could escape. But that idea of rescuing Yazidis from captivity, ISIS captivity, and often slavery, continued after the siege was lifted, and he's continued to do this. He's a member of a group called an underground railroad called the Mosquitoes. Tell us a little about the Mosquitoes.
Yes. The Mosquitoes came about after Shaker fled to Germany, which many people did at the time, many Iraqis, many Yazidis. So he fled there, and he started working to help get girls out of the camps, because a lot of the girls were actually being kidnapped in Greece in the camps. So he started doing that, and he started trying to get girls who had been taken with their captors to different places all over. And so he was forming a network online with other Yazidis to find other Yazidis. So that's how it started online, as sort of an underground online railroad. That's how he met a woman named Anne Nerona, who is a nurse. She's in Cornwall, and she was very much involved with the Yazidis. And she would go down to the camps to look after their medical needs and realize the Yazidis were being persecuted. They were being kidnapped. And she also had her own rescue organization. And they realized that the two of them together and Shaker could join their networks. And they had a specialized secret Facebook group called the Mosquitoes, which really addressed only the most vulnerable Yazidis. And very few people knew about it at the time, and they coordinated help for the Yazidis. And it's quite extraordinary. It's sort of like a World War II underground resistance movement. They still operate today.
Yeah, and you would think when he moved to Germany, he would be somewhat safe. But what we found out is, yes, as you write in the book, that ISIS has also infiltrated this refugee route, and he's still a wanted man even in Germany.
Oh, yes. When I met him, he was in the hospital. He had just infiltrated ISIS. He went behind enemy lines to get someone out, and he was emaciated. He hadn't eaten. He was living on maggots in the forest, and because, especially after doing that, they really came after him. He was targeted first as a combat interpreter, but then he became targeted as a rescuer, and also because he used to go online and get in arguments with him, in fact. And they knew exactly who he was. They knew what he did on the mountain, and they knew that he was rescuing girls from the camps and all over the place. So he was targeted in Germany, where a lot of extremists made their way in, hiding themselves among the hordes of migrants coming in. And some of them even had Yazidis with them who they were just keeping. So they targeted him. They followed him on trains. They've stabbed him. They've beaten him up. He's called me on the phone many times on WhatsApp to get help. And so it's a very dangerous situation for him because they know exactly who he is and he keeps having to change locations. Right now, he's trying to live a very peaceful existence, living as an ordinary person to get the heat off of himself while he waits to get a visa to the United States. And also, you know, he needs a break, I think, from a lot of what he's doing. Even though he still does some work, it's not as much as before, but he's still being targeted. He's very much in their crosshairs.
And of course, that's the other sort of frustrating part of his story is here's a man that took great personal risks to help Americans in Iraq.
Yeah.
And like many other interpreters, some interpreters have made it to the United States. Many have not. And and in the last several years, the ability to come to the United States for these interpreters has basically ended for the most part.
For the most part. There's been a 99% reduction since 2016. So there were like 325 who came in 2016, 196 in 2017, two in 2018, and probably about the same in last year. So it's been a huge reduction. It's a big problem because there are about 50,000 of them still waiting. And the process is so tangled, so difficult. I'm in the middle of the process with him, and it's really unbelievable how difficult it is to get someone in. Even someone like him, who's really more American than many Americans, who's risked his life for our country. So it's shocking.
And meanwhile, he's in Germany. Again, as you say, he's laying low. But at the meantime, you're telling his story in this book, which you write it as an autobiography in his own words. Why that decision?
Mm-hmm. It's his story. And I've done this before. I've worked with my last book. I did the same thing. He's the best person. His voice is the best voice to express what happened. But he doesn't have book writing ability, if you want to call it that. So he also has PTSD, which means his memory was all over the place, and I really needed to work with him. It's not just an ordinary person writing their autobiography. You're dealing with a trauma victim and also somebody who's still in the throes of a genocide. So, and a marked person. So writing a book for him, his memoir, was not going to be possible alone. So he really needed someone to shepherd him through and work through the process with him, and we became one mind working on this project together over the course of a couple of years, at least.
The name of the book is Shadow on the Mountain. Catherine Holstein, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Catherine Holstein is a writer and human rights advocate who tells the story of U.S. Special Forces interpreter Shaker Jeffrey in the book Shadow on the Mountain, a Yazidi memoir of terror, resistance, and hope. It's published by DeCapo. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.